Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with L. Peter Callender, Artistic Director of the African American Shakespeare Company, and actress Jameer Jenkins to talk about the current AASC production of A Streetcar Named Desire. Also stopping by are the dynamic duo Kate Kilbane and Dan Moses of the Oakland-based theatrical rock band The Kilbanes to share details about Weightless, which is an adaptation from Ovid's Metamorphoses at Z-Space. Should be an interesting conversation. From professional chamber choir Capella SF, we'll talk with Grammy Award-winning conductor Ragnar Bolin once again in studio to talk about Sirens, Songs from the Bay, which is a contemporary choral music concert which will feature the song cycle Sirens by Mason Bates, as well as works by four Capella SF singer-composers. Plus a brief conversation with American virtuoso flutist Robert Stallman about Romantic Impulses, his concert which will be presented tomorrow night at Old First Concerts on Sacramento Street. Stay with us. For those listeners who aren't familiar with the award-winning African-American Shakespeare Company, where have you been? Get thee to a production. The company was established back in 1994 by professional theater artists from ACT as an alternative answer to the colorblind casting initiative that began in the early 90s, something that we'll talk a bit about with our guest artistic director, L. Peter Callender. In addition to being the artistic director of African-American Shakespeare Company, Peter has been a visiting professor of theater arts and performance studies at Stanford, a teaching artist at Waterfront Conservatory Theater in Berkeley, and for some 20 years, an associate artist at Cal Shakes. He's an award-winning director both in the Bay Area, where he has directed for AASC and the Aurora, and at American Stage Theater in St. Petersburg, Florida, where he just directed A Raisin in the Sun. He's also an award-winning actor, performing both on and off Broadway and in dozens of theater companies around the country, and in over 25 Shakespeare plays throughout his career, garnering high praise from audiences and critics alike. He'll play the lead in Shakespeare's Richard III at the company this July. Always a pleasure to welcome Peter Callender back to our studios. Hey, Peter. Well,
thank you so much. What a nice opening. Well, so nice. Thank you. Is that really me?
That's only a part. That's we could go on, but the
thank
show's
you.
Only an hour.
That's so nice. Thank you.
He's joined by Jameer Jenkins, who plays the iconic role of Blanche DuBois in Streetcar. Jameer is a podcaster, teaching artist, creative director of Black Watt Entertainment, and she's currently pursuing a master's degree at Syracuse University's Whitman School of Management. Among other companies, she appeared in the African-American Shakespeare production of Jitney and was Molly in the American stage production of Joe Turner's Come and Gone. Jameer, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, Peter, this is a complicated time to be presenting such a classic, complicated 1947 Tennessee Williams play, a study in male power, sexual violence. Tell us how you're approaching this in this atmosphere.
Well, thanks again for that wonderful introduction. Again, thank you. And when we first decided to do this, I wanted to do this play and not base it on race. I wanted to base it on class. I wanted to base it on the class structure. I took out a lot of the race language out of the play, the Polack, the pole language, there's a couple of words that Stanley uses, and I took all that out. It wasn't right for this time, and I also thought about the Me Too that's happening all around the country right now, and
sure,
certainly should happen all around the world. And I thought about that, and I thought about what if we did this play and just put it out there, and I wanted also to have professionals come and talk with the cast and do a talk back. We are having a talk back from a woman's group, a Women Against Violence group that's coming in to do a talk back with us. So it's important to me that this play resonates with everybody and make sure that we have a safe environment and talk openly about the topics of the play.
Well, let's back up for a moment in the way that you're changing some of the script. Now, I know that there's some very strict procedures involved in presenting a standard book musical theater work put on by the publishers and the estates of the various composers that you can't change anything. Mm-hmm. If you change anything, you're null and void. What's going on? So how is this possible with Tennessee Williams' work?
Well, I copied a few things from the Broadway show, and it's allowed. We have permission to do that. For example, Stanley and Stella were going to Galatoire's in the original script. Well, Galatoire's back in those days did not allow black people. It was one of those places that said, no, only white folks. So to have a black actors playing Stanley and Stella and the incomparable Jameer Jenkins playing Blanche, to have them go to Galatoire's didn't make sense. There was a restaurant, bar, club called Dookie Chase back in those days that a lot of people of color went to. So that was changed to Dookie Chase. That was also changed on the Broadway show. So these small things, for example, when Eunice refers to Stanley as something, I don't even know the words anymore because I deleted it, something of a Pollock, I thought that's just, I don't want to hear that, and we didn't want to keep that in the play in our production.
Are you adding the N-word as a stinger in the
Absolutely
other way?
Absolutely not. No.
All right.
In few things that I can use that word, I would do it. I don't. As a matter of fact, I didn't really eliminate it. Let me tell you, once you see the show, she's upstairs and she's yelling. And you know, Stanley does that. Stella!
Can't you hear me yella?
Can't you hear me yella, Stella? Yeah. So just as she's about to say the P word, let me put it that way, Pollock, I have Stanley yell, Stella! So it drowns out the fact that she's using those words. So I didn't really cut it. I just sort of muted it a little bit. Which I thought was so smart. I didn't want people thinking that this leaving the play thinking it was a play about race. It's not. It's a play about class. It's a play about this structure that Blanche DuBois has infiltrated, that has come and shakes it up a little bit. These two people who are terribly in love with each other. And right or wrong, Stanley's brutality, right or wrong, is Stanley's brutality. And I'm not apologizing for that. It's open there. It's out there. People can take what they can from it. He's a brute in some sort. Blanche calls him a brute. Tennessee Williams calls him a brute. So I don't mind calling him a brute here.
Mm. So there's got to be a balance of preserving the author's original intentions,
of course,
and not varying what his message is overall.
No, the message is very clear. What Tennessee Williams wrote, it's absolutely very clear. I'm pinching certain things from the Broadway show that was allowed at that time as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that if Conan O'Brien and The Simpsons can create Streetcar the Musical,
exactly.
Peter Callender can have his way with
a couple of words
from African American Shakes.
Yes, and they did a great job with that too. It was so good. It was so funny.
Well, tell us about your wonderful cast, including Miss Jenkins.
Oh my! I tell you, sometimes as a director, you luck out, and this time I didn't. No, I'm just kidding. I'm teasing. No,
ouch! Thank you for coming in, Jameer.
Is this
the
thing
door
on?
Is that way.
Thank you. It was good while it lasted.
I got lucky with a number of cast members.
Well, you can always be. Rely on the kindness of strangers.
Yes. Ooh, that's good.
Ooh,
Someone is prepared. I did. I lucked out with a number of cast members in this production. Certainly the woman to my left. When you'd mentioned Molly in Joe Turner, and one of the reviewers who complimented her work as Molly in Joe Turner suggested that she would be a wonderful Blanche. And this was a year ago. Soon after that production, and I directed that production, that's where Jimmy and I first met. And soon after that production, I told her that I would be interested in doing Streetcar. But then it went back to other plays and other plays, other plays. Then we went back to Streetcar. And she was available, and the time was right, and she had a terrific audition. And here she is, and she's wonderful as Blanche. She's different, it's unique, she's poised, she's lyrical, she is tender, she's fragile, she's flighty, she's cool, she's moody, and she's ugly at times, brash at times. And you look at Blanche and you say, wow, I feel for her. At times I don't like her very much, but I feel for her. And that's, I think that's what a good performance does for that, for those people sitting in the dark watching this amazing play.
Jameer, have you worked with Peter before?
Yes, he and I originally met in St. Petersburg, Florida, where I'm from, in his production of Joe Turner's Come and Gone at the American Stage. I played Molly Cunningham.
Must have made quite an impression then. It's fantastic.
It was an amazing opportunity for me. It was the first time. After I graduated from college, I went to Florida State. I moved to New York. And so for many of my family members who still lived in Florida, it was their first opportunity to see me perform his production. And it was my dad's first time seeing me on stage, and he cried opening night. So it's a memory that I will hold on to for the rest of my life. And through that experience, artistically, I grew in a way that I hadn't in any other of my previous work. And I am a huge fan of L. Peter Callender and the work that he does with African American Shakespeare Company, and I'm delighted to join them again in this production. I've worked, I also was blessed enough to work on his production of Winter's Tale last year. And so I'm a huge fan of his and of Sherry's and the company, and I love the work that they're doing. I'm a benefit of colorblind casting, and so it's very important that other people have the same opportunities that were presented for me.
Mm. Peter, can we talk a little bit about that alternative to colorblind casting? How are you bringing out more of your Black African Americans' culture in your casting and in their interpretation?
Yeah, good question. I always say, look, if you give Wynton Marsalis the score to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, right, and you say, you know, everybody knows who Wynton Marsalis is, right? And you say, Wynton, just give me your version of this. You'll still hear dun 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 dun, right? But it'll have a coolness to it. It'll have a sweetness. It'll have a jazzy thing to it. It'll have a moody thing to it. It'll have a sexy thing to it. And you'll think, I've heard that music before, but why am I just melting in my seat? How did he play that note? What is this, the fifth, or is the, you know? So I think what we do at African American Shakespeare Company is we take these classics, and we don't say they are the white classic plays, or they're American stories. They all are. I directed Cat in the Hot Tin Roof a few years ago. The one woman who has seen a production of the play in London with a black cast and saw the production on Broadway with a black cast and then came to see our production with a full black cast and asked me very, very seriously and says, Mr. Callender, I really enjoyed your production. Do you think this production can ever be done with a white cast? True story.
Ultimate compliment.
Absolutely true story. I just want to make sure that these stories are told in word for word for the most part, but they are American stories, and with a little spice, and I want audiences to audience members of the black community to say, yeah, that guy reminds me of my uncle, reminds me of my auntie, reminds me of my brother, and I get a lot of that, and I think that's where the success of African American Shakespeare Company doing the classics with color comes from.
You mentioned that you've taken out some of the slurs that are used in terms of referring to Stanley Kowalski, but are you keeping him as the name, Stanley Kowalski?
Yeah, that's another thing. for example,
this is all very much to a specific time and place that Tennessee intended with Blanche DuBois and the whole New Orleans.
It is, and we're keeping all that. It's just that when Blanche comes in and she says, "I'm looking for my sister, Stella DuBois." I mean, Stella. Oh yes, that's the party. So we are. There's the name Kowalski is not mentioned in the production per se, because I didn't want people thinking Kowalski, really?
He's not a Kowalski.
He can't be a Kowalski. So I'm not eliminating it, but it's just people slightly cut her off in the wrong time when she speaks. But it's working very, very well. And audiences are loving it so far, and the reviews have told us that. And the audience members who saw it opening night, we had over 500 people there the opening night, and a lovely standing ovation. So they got it.
That's great. Now speaking of this colorblind casting and the advances that not only African American Shakespeare Company but other companies have brought through, did you think that finally, in 2008, we had bridged a gap? We had become a little bit less of a colorblind country with Barack Obama, and now look what's happened again.
It's history. Don't get me started.
I know. We could spend the rest of the hour here.
Sorry, yeah. Guys. You guys are not going on right now. This is...
We got it.
Yeah, man, look, we thought we'd gotten so far. We all said that, oh, yes, now we have an African-American president. It's all gone away. It just went under the table a little bit. It just took the longer freeway around. It hasn't gone away. I was very lucky coming up in the business with colorblind casting. I was very lucky to have played kings and dukes and princes in Shakespeare and some of the great American classics and European classic plays. And I was very lucky. I was given that opportunity. And I'm hoping that more and more and more actors and directors get an opportunity to do the classics and use actors because of their ability, not because of their skin color. Use actors because they speak well, because they move well, because they audition well. The reason why I'm in the Bay Area was Tony Ciccone auditioned me for Adolphus Cousins in Major Barbara, and I was the only actor of color at the audition at the time. I was 15 actors waiting outside the door, and I was the only actor of color. And I went in, and I did my thing. And he asked me, he gave me an adjustment, and did it again. And he offered me the role right then and there.
Wow!
And I came out here, and I was the only African American member of the company at that time. So I was given the role because of my ability, not because of the color of my skin. And he told me that. He said, I cast the best actor. And I want that more and more and more for actors of color, certainly for Jameer Jenkins as well.
Well, we'll look forward to your interpretation of Richard III in July.
Thank you very, very much. I'm looking forward to that as well, because Kirsten Brandt is directing. And real quick, we're looking to say, what if we play Richard the way he sees himself and not the way others see him? So he sees himself as a although he speaks of himself being crooked and born before, he sees himself as very handsome and debonair when he looks in the mirror, you know. So we're starting with that sense, and as the play goes on, he gets more and more crooked because he's losing everything that he believed in. So we're looking at in that conceptual idea.
Interesting.
Thanks for the plug.
Well, we'll have you back. Well, let's get back to Streetcar Named Desire and go out with a brief excerpt of Blanche and Jameer Jenkins. Thanks for being in, Peter.
Sure, thank you.
He was just a boy when I was a very young girl. When I was 16, I made the discovery. Love. All at once and much, much too completely. It was like you turned a blinding light on something that had always been half in shadow. That's how it struck the world for me. But I was unlucky. Deluded. There was something different about the boy, a nervousness, a softness and tenderness which wasn't like a man's, although he wasn't the least bit effeminate looking. Still, that thing was there. He came to me for help. I didn't know that. I didn't know anything until after our marriage. We'd run away and come back, and all I knew was I'd failed him in some mysterious way and wasn't able to give him the help that he needed but couldn't speak of. He was in the quicksands and clutching at me, but I wasn't holding him out. I was slipping in with him. I didn't know that. I didn't know anything except I loved him unendurably. But without being able to help him or help myself. And then I found out, in the worst of all possible ways.
that coming into a room which I thought was empty, which wasn't empty, but I had two people in it. A boy I had married and an older man who had been his friend for years.
Jameer Jenkins as Blanche Dubois in the African-American Shakespeare production of A Streetcar Named Desire, 1947 Tennessee Williams play. Jameer, thank you so much for
that.
Thank
you so much for having us
for taking the time today. Peter, we'll have you in again, of
always,
course.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your support.
Information at african-americanshakes.org. In addition to the actor talkbacks after the productions, you're invited to a special pre-performance brunch on prior to the final performance on March 18th, where you can meet and mingle with fellow theater lovers, Streetcar cast members, as well as Peter Callender and the AASC's board of directors. Again, more information for the Streetcar Named Desire production at african-americanshakes.org. Brief excerpt of from Weightless, Breath and Your Bones by the Kilbanes. Z-Space and Piece by Piece Productions are about midway through the world premiere of the full production of the Kilbanes' Weightless, which has been some 5 years in the making. Back in 2016, a concert version of the Kilbanes' rock opera Weightless was dubbed by the Chronicle as one of the top 10 theater picks of 2016, and an early iteration of Weightless won Best of Fringe at the Fringe Festival in 2012. SF Weekly called it one of the best shows of the year and named Kate Kilbane one of the Bay Area's 11 theater artists to watch in 2013. And the Chronicle described Weightless as an outright revelation. High praise indeed. Weightless is an interpretation of Ovid's Metamorphoses through intimate storytelling and the Kilbanes' celebrated indie rock sound. It explores the bonds of sisterhood and the power of the female voice. The Kilbanes are a captivating voice in the Bay Area music and theater scenes. The Oakland-based theatrical rock band is the brainchild of husband-wife songwriters, the dynamic duo of Kate Kilbane and Dan Moses, who join me in studio now. Dan, Kate, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, tell us how this work, if you'll pardon the use of the word, metamorphosed over these past 5 years into this major production now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, of course, like everything we do, it started with the music. Dan and I have been a working rock band since we got married. And we started writing these songs and playing them in clubs back in 2011, 2012. For us, songs are always driven by story, and story is at the center of everything we do. So when we began the process, it really was about finding a way to connect with audiences in bars and coffee shops and tell parts of this story through these songs. And then we got the opportunity to do the Fringe Festival, which was actually our first theatrical venture as the Kilbanes. And we thought, well, let's try it. Let's see what happens if we put this in a slightly more theatrical context and really tell the story from beginning to end and see what we have here and if audiences connect with it and if we connect with the work in this form. And we loved it. It was a great way to tell the story. It was a great way of moving through the music and giving our audience sort of a deeper connection to the music. So that's how it started. And then
you know, we really had this dream of creating a full theatrical production, which, of course, is a monster, so it takes a long time.
And it's such an honor to have this start the 25th season of Z-Space.
Yeah. It is a huge honor, yes. Z-Space has been a partner of ours since the Fringe Festival. Yeah. Lisa Steinler came and saw the piece and was really interested in helping us develop it. And so we've spent the last several years doing workshops at Z-Space, trying on ideas, figuring out how to expand it and how to really create a frame for it that will hold the music. And so it's beautiful that we can be a part of this 25th season.
So why Ovid? Is this your light reading list for summer beach reading that led you to choose Metamorphosis?
I'm afraid it is, David. I have to confess. I'm the child of two English professors. And so Ovid is something that I have spent time with, you know, since my high school and college days. And particularly, I think it is the combination of very human emotions and experiences and also magic and transformation that is exciting to me about this kind of work.
That's my familiarization. I called him Ovid, so it's Ovid.
Oh,
thank you.
You know
for
what?
Correcting.
I don't think his agent is coming after either of us. So, so for me, this particular story, actually, what was powerful about it was the moment in the story where one of the characters, a couple of spoiler alerts, it's 2,000 years old, there's not such a thing, I suppose, gets her tongue cut out and she's not able to speak. She wants to call out to her sister and tell her what's happened to her. And she can't, of course, but she remembers that she can weave. She's a weaver. And so she weaves the story of what happens to her into a tapestry and finds a way to get it to her sister. And
wow.
For both Dan and me, this moment of a woman finding a way to tell her story and actually to speak about violence done to her, even when she seems to have no options left, was incredibly powerful and worth, you know, writing a whole opera.
Well, we'll talk about it being a very contemporary topic right now. That's
yes.
Amazing that yeah. This is, you know, it's a classic story for a reason.
It's actually incredible. My father-in-law sent me a New Yorker article about Ovid and the Me Too movement that was published 3 weeks before we started rehearsals. And it was all about trying to reclaim stories of female violence and tell these stories through the perspective, from the female perspective, and creating a sense of agency. So,
and we all thought we were supposed to be learning from history.
Exactly.
You know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So Dan, how have these stories developed and these songs developed over the years, really?
Oh. Well, I mean, you know, along with the production, you know, it took many, many forms. We the songs themselves, you know, we always start with sort of a raw emotional moment and try to really, you know, just embody that as best we can with the music. And so the music itself actually have sort of become these linchpins that sort of underlie the whole thing. And then so what changes actually is less the music as it is the what's happening around the music and how it you know the context sort of gives it certain details and brings to light aspects of the music that maybe weren't there before. The show itself, you know, we struggle as, or let's say we struggle happily as musical theater writers trying to find ways to tell a story with music that's, you know, perhaps different from a traditional musical where people talk and then they sing, and there is talking and there is singing. But you know, what's been exciting, sort of in the development of this piece, is really finding a way for the story to be told in a way that is feels of a piece with the music and with the plot itself.
Yeah, I think to add to that. So as students of musical theater, often in a musical theater song, the song itself will advance the plot, will teach you something sort of specific and significant, and we don't expect that from rock and roll, right? Because of the nature of the way the instruments interact with the voices, because of the voices themselves, right? Which are often sort of gruff and distended in certain ways. And we, as rock musicians, wanted to feel free of the burden of advancing the plot so that we could really just explore emotional moments, as Dan was saying. But that, of course, means that the burden of advancing the plot and telling the story happens elsewhere. Mm. So that has been, you know, figuring out how we can get you from one emotional moment to the other with enough information and grounding to understand the emotional moment we'd like to take you on next has been the project.
Mm. So this is different from the concert version. What will we actually see on the Z-Space stage?
Well, it's interesting. It actually ended up very much as a hybrid. It sort of lives between worlds, which is exactly what we meant to do. So that's thrilling. So it will look like a concert in that we sing into microphones. I play one of the main characters, and I'm also the bassist. So you see me playing as I'm singing. One of our other leads is our lead guitarist as well. So he's playing a character. He's also got a huge pedal board, and he's creating these incredible environments. But we are now, we built a really beautiful immersive environment in Z-Space. So our audience, rather than sitting in the traditional risers, if you've ever been to Z-Space, is actually in a series of sort of banked risers on either side of the stage. So I think of it as a giant boat that we're all on together. We also have incredible projections and lighting. So we don't use a lot of physical props, but our story, the images and the story and the environments are created by Hannah Kim, was the projection designer, and Ray Oppenheimer was our lighting designer. And they collaborated beautifully on helping us really transform the room over and over again as we get sort of deeper into the story. And of course, Becca Wolf, who's our director, did a beautiful job staging moments, you know, and creating a sort of sense of flow and rhythm to connect with the audience and to really highlight different moments in the story.
Well, your first rock opera, The Medea Cycle, has played all over the Bay Area as well as L.A., New York, Dallas. Is this something you want to do with the Ovid as well?
Yes, we would absolutely love to tour it. We're hoping to move it all over the place. Yeah.
One thing that's exciting, too, is that you're using the pre-concert or the pre-show times to showcase a lot of great independent bands. Tell us about some of the groups that are going to be lined up for this.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, we are incredibly biased because we chose all the openers. We think they're all brilliant and amazing. Last night, for example, we had the Alegre Sisters, which is they were a beautiful trio, two sisters singing, and then they had an instrumentalist with them. Rafael Saria, who is an incredible, celebrated musician on the indie scene, his band is called La Gente, and he opened for us last Saturday night and shared his music, which is a combination of sort of Latin music and cumbia and hip-hop and those sorts of influences. Coming up next week, we have Kat Robichaud, who's another incredible, celebrated artist who runs something called the Misfit Cabaret, is much more sort of vaudevillian, sort of punk-influenced rock and roll. So it really does span all different genres. But all of the musicians that are opening for us are incredible local musicians. And that was really important to us to sort of try to bridge the theater world and the music world and introduce some theater audiences to these incredible musicians that we know and have come up, you know, and learned about through playing in the club scene.
Nice. So we're going to go out with a really infectiously beautiful tune from Waitlist called Diana and Actaeon. Tell us a little bit about this tune.
So this is a story within a story, if you will. This is actually a separate Greek myth, also, I think, from Ovid, yes?
Mm-hmm. She shows up.
Also about a transformation. It's a little bit of foreshadowing, but this is a story of the goddess Diana, who is surrounded by her what do we call them, women of the woods.
Indeed.
And doesn't want any mortal men to ever see her, and of course one does. This hunter Actaeon sees her, falls in love with her, and so she decides that's worthy of punishment, and turns him into a deer and has his own dogs eat him.
You know, just typical rock music fare.
Dan Moses, Kate Kilbane, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
The Kilbanes is at Z-Space through the 18th of March with some great pre-rock shows, hand-selected by Kate and Dan. More information at zspace.org. And now a little bit of Diana and Actaeon.
Diana in the forest at the dawning of the day, quiver full of arrows and the sun to light their way. She rises from the earth and feels the wind upon her face. Her body like a statue in her eyes a shining green. She's standing in the water, all her ladies at her feet. Her women of the woods, they do exactly as they please. Just as they please, they love her with abandon. All her power and her magic let her live a life that no one can imagine. Hey! Hey! hands are moving slowly through the trees. He comes upon Diana and he falls upon his knees, astonished by a beauty that nobody ever sees. They never see. He laughs her with abandon, and he tells her all the things that he can give her that he's sure she can't imagine. He doesn't see her arrow fly, hits him right between the eyes, but he can feel the change. It must break his tender skin. He's half a deer and half a man. He turns and runs away, his body blows away and down. He tries to scream his name and finds he cannot make a sound. And he hears them coming and he knows it is the hounds. It is the hounds, they're ending with abandon, and his blood is in their eyes, and he can see an end that no one can imagine. Hector looks up to the sky. He cannot scream the question why. They find him in the trees. The dogs, they sing their bloody song. Diana smiles that she is gone. She brought him to his knees. She brought him to his knees. She brought him to his knees. To his knees.
To his knees.
That infectious new take on the classics from Weightless, based on Ovid's Metamorphoses. Diana and Actaeon, music by Dan Moses and Kate Kilbanes. The Kilbanes, productions through March 18th at Z Space, celebrating their 25th anniversary. And some great bands to hear prior to each performance. More information at zspace.org. Well, contemporary music with a reach back from into texts, ancient and contemporary, are going to be presented at Mission Dolores Basilica this Sunday at 7:30. If you've been listening to KLW, you've heard that we are a media sponsor for Capella SF, which is Ragnar Bolin's incredible vocal ensemble. Their concert on Sunday will focus on the beautiful sounds of truly contemporary 21st century music that pleases the ear. Ragnar Bolin founded the professional chamber choir Capella SF in 2014. As their director, he's recorded a Christmas CD, Light of Gold, and Facing West, a CD with music by Bay Area composers David Conte and Conrad Souza. If you're a fan of the San Francisco Symphony, you've no doubt heard the fruits of his labor there, as he's been chorus director of the San Francisco Symphony since March of 2007. In 2010, the San Francisco Symphony and Chorus garnered three Grammy Awards for the recording of Mahler's Symphony No. 8, including for Best Choral Performance under Ragnar's direction. And in addition to work with these two ensembles, Ragnar has won awards for his work with Stockholm's KFUM Chamber Choir, the Maria Magdalena Motet Choir, and the Maria Vocal Ensemble. And as faculty member of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, continues to finely hone the ensembles there. Ragnar, such a pleasure to welcome you back to Open Air.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
And to be joined by Cordy Fengler, the CEO of Capella SF. Cordy, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, David.
Well, Ragnar, what inspired you to craft this particular program? You've got some amazing composers in their own right as members of your choir. Is that the initial inspiration for doing something like this?
Yes, it's partly that we have wonderful composers within our own ranks, and the fact that I was completely blown away 10 years ago when I heard Mason Bates' Sirens being premiered by Chanticleer, who commissioned the piece as well. And I thought to myself when hearing it that this is among the best chorus a cappella music that I've heard in a decade or two. And I've been waiting ever since for an opportunity to perform Sirens. We have already performed Book of Matthew, which is the fifth wonderful movement from Sirens, a couple of times with Capella SF.
Which we'll hear shortly.
Right, but now for the first time we're performing the whole piece.
Let's come back to Mason in just a minute, because we're going to go out with some of his music and talk about some of the other composers that are represented and how you discovered their music.
Well, it's Elliot Encarnacion and Elizabeth Kimball and Clayton Moser who wrote music for this concert. And I know them since they were kids, I'm tempted to say. They sang under my direction at the conservatory some 5-6 years ago in the conservatory chamber choir. And then now they sing in the symphony chorus with me. And they've kept me abreast with the work that they produce. And I've been looking also for a long time for an opportunity to present their works. And we also have a wonderful arrangement by Ben Jones, a previous Chanticleer singer who also sings now in the symphony chorus with me, an arrangement of Villa-Lobos Bachianas Brasileiras number 5. This will be ending the concert.
That sounds like it's going to be an incredible experience. I know Ben Jones' voice quite well. It's really nice. Cordy Fengler, you must have seen this group blossom under the direction of Ragnar. It's pretty amazing.
It's an absolute joy to watch it happen. And, you know, I've been singing with the symphony chorus now for nearly 25 years. And when Ragnar came 10 years ago, we were very, very excited. And since have seen his craft, it's astounding. And I think you probably know that audiences know that because they get up and roar, and we're totally thrilled. Then the opportunity to help him realize this dream that he had to truly present professional choral music of the highest caliber was extremely tempting. And so since I'm a retired person, I decided I'd jump right in and see what I could do.
Nice. The piece of Wild Things by Elizabeth Kimball will be performed with Ben Jones also as tenor soloist. And then Elizabeth has a chance to do a solo during the morning of the morning work. The name of the work is The Morning by Clayton Moser. Tell us about that piece, Ragnar, if you would.
Well, it's a piece that Clayton wrote for this occasion, and it's about renewed hope after defeat. It's interesting that all the three pieces written for us by Elliot, Elizabeth, and Clayton have the same theme. Elliot's piece is a text by Wilfred Owen, actually the text part that was not incorporated into Britain's War Requiem, the only piece of text that Britain did not use. So here Elliot puts that to music, and it's of course very dire against war and about the horrors of war. And Elizabeth Kimball's piece, the piece of Wild Things, is also about the worries of the world, but how you can find solace in nature and in wild things. And Clayton's piece has the same theme about hope.
And then getting on to Mason Bates' work, The Sirens, pulls texts from all kinds of sources in addition to the Book of Matthew.
Right, so we're singing in 5 different languages, starting with Greek. It's from the Odyssey, so it's written 2,800 years ago, roughly, by Homer, about, of course, the sirens calling Odysseus and trying to lure him when he's sailing past their island. And it's so captivating the way Mason depicted this with voices echoing back and forth. This comes back in the 6th movement, where we also sing in Greek and English. The 2nd movement, Die Lorelei, is based on a poem by Heinrich Heine from the 19th century, based on the tradition of Die Lorelei, a beautiful woman sitting on the shores of the Rhine, luring fishermen to a death by not paying attention to the shoals or rocks that they bump into. Stelle is a text from the 16th century, an Italian text that talks about the stars having each one of them a siren behind them. And these are benevolent sirens, so sirens don't necessarily have to be something dangerous, which is proven in this movement. And then the 4th movement, same thing. It's a Quechua, the Indian tribe Quechua, that is talking about a man hiding from the rain, sitting in a cave, and there is a siren appearing in front of him, dancing. And this is perhaps the most groovy music. It's almost like rock and roll for a moment there. And the 5th movement is a piece from Book of Matthew in the Bible about Jesus calling his disciples, telling them to lay off their nets and come fish for men instead.
To become fishers of men, indeed.
And one of the exciting things in this concert is, that not only do they sing in five languages in Sirens, but there's Portuguese in the final piece of the program. So this is an extremely talented group that is very flexible.
Well, you, as a member of the symphony chorus and now witnessing Ragnar's work with Capella SF, he must have a certain inspirational element to get everything out of this chorus that he possibly can without resorting to his black belt in karate, is it?
Aikido.
He kills us with kindness, I think. It is indeed his technique of bringing the best of all of us out, whatever the group is, and that is from a group that might be string players who are having to sing at the symphony chorus, at the conservatory, all the way to the professionals, to pull out, because people love to make that sound magic and wonderful. And I was at the rehearsal last night and magic was happening. So we're looking forward to magic happening on Sunday night too.
Sunday at 7:30 at Mission Dolores Basilica here in San Francisco, capellasf.org. In addition to other members of the chorus, Mason Bates' Sirens is being featured. Mason being the composer in residence at the Kennedy Center, which prevented him from being here today with us. He's been a guest on Open Air before, and I'm proud to count him as a good friend. Amazing guy, and we're going to hear some of his amazing music now from Sirens, from the Book of Matthew. Thank you, Ragnar, for coming in, Cordy as well. Looking forward to the concert.
Thank you.
Music of Mason Bates from Sirens from the Book of Matthew. An excerpt from Mason Bates' 2009 work, originally written for Chanticleer, from Sirens. In that particular movement, from the Book of Matthew, making you fishers of men. Several languages being represented in that 2009 work, which you can hear sung by Capella SF this Sunday at 7:30 at Mission Dolores Basilica. CapellaSF.org for more information. Once again, CapellaSF.org. Always wonderful musical opportunities here in the Bay Area, including one tomorrow night at Old First Church, which is featuring one of the most prominent flutists of our time and in the direct lineage of teaching of Jean-Pierre Rampal. And I'm speaking of Robert Stallman, who makes his biannual or maybe an annual visit to the Bay Area and treats us not only to incredible concerts, but master classes as well, for which he kindly invited me to participate in this past Sunday at the home of Isabella Chapuis, who is the principal flutist, also a Jean-Pierre Rampal disciple, she's principal flutist of the opera San Jose. Robert's joining me now from San Jose. Robert, how are you?
David, hi. Yes, I want to say it was wonderful to see you and to hear you play on Sunday. Let me just say briefly, you are always amaze me because you are sometimes as good as all of the professionals I hear, and you don't have any time to practice. I don't know how you do it.
Well, it's, I like to say jack of all trades, master of none. How's that? You're very kind.
I've always been a master.
Well, tell us how this concert came together. You're calling it the Romantic Impulses.
Yes. Well, if I'd done a classical program, I couldn't have said classical impulses. It doesn't quite do it. Or Baroque Impulses. But I wanted to do a program of romantic composers, and in particular some works that I've recently transcribed for flute from piano works or whatever. Actually, there's one that's by Dvorak for a string quintet, which I'll do next week on a different program, that I reduced to flute and piano, and I think it's going to work. It'll be a maiden voyage next week. But this concert tomorrow at Old First Church, and by the way, it's at 8 o'clock, Romantic Impulses starts with, I think, really the first romantic composer we have. That's Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. He really began the whole movement, although people didn't realize it until Beethoven came along and said, without him, I wouldn't be me. But he also, at the same time, began the classical movement. He was a son, of course, of J.S. Bach, and he had his own style. But incorporated with his own style were two other styles. One was sort of a pre-romantic style, which means a very personal expression of his feelings, or what he called Empfindsamkeit in German. And the other was a kind of almost precognition of what was to come the classical style. And Haydn would have said, I wouldn't be Haydn without C.P. Bach, and Mozart said the same thing. So he's a major influence, but he's never appreciated the way he should be. But this is a beautiful sonata that he wrote when he was 17, and the Bach family had just moved, I believe, from Köthen, Germany, to J.S. Bach's new position as the choir director and organist at St. Thomas Church in Leipzig. So it's an amazing piece. So then after that...
Hold on a second there,
yes,
Bob.
Yes.
In this amazing bit of synchronicity, you know whose birthday it is today?
Ravel was, I thought, yesterday, no?
Well, today is Carl...
Oh, today's Bach's birthday.
Today is Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach's birthday.
Is it C.P. Bach's birthday today?
It is.
I'm on top of it. I left my birthday book back in Massachusetts.
Well, there you go.
Is something. Well, I'll mention that tomorrow. We just had Ravel's birthday, and now this. Yeah, and of course, his father's birthday is the 21st of March.
Right, right. So, yeah, go
well,
on.
You keep in touch with this stuff. So anyway, I have a new piece, rather new piece that I've arranged of Dvorak. I've done a whole series this year of Dvorak works for flute, and they're being published now. I've had several different publishers in the past, but now I'm with Carl Fisher in New York, which is another major company.
Well, I have to thank you for some of these transcriptions and adding to our repertoire so wonderfully.
Oh, you have some? Yeah. Well, thank you for saying so. I hope you play. I know you're going to play them.
Well, you know, you mentioned that you've added works by Mozart that aren't necessarily for flute into our repertoire. You've adapted a piano sonata of Schubert, which is a lovely sonata now for flute and piano, yes. Courtesy of your stylings. Fantastic.
Yes, yes. Along with the Dvorak pieces, I've been doing a bit of Ravel. So those Ravel pieces are published. They're three works. And so I was saying the Dvorak work is originally for piano, actually. It's called The American Suite, which is not interesting as a piano piece. And in fact, Dvorak seemed to realize that himself, as he took the piano work and orchestrated for full orchestra. It's a brilliant piece, if you know it. It's played fairly often now, but 10 years ago, nobody played it in this country. And so I took it and went backwards from the orchestral version to a flute piano version, the American Suite. And then following that in the first half is this Ravel Sonatine, which I did publish a year ago for the first time for flute and piano. It's one of Ravel's most popular piano works. It's one that he himself performed when he toured this country. That was the piece he played along with others. And it's quite a feat for the pianist to get all the notes in, and the flute just sings on top of it, and it's a beautiful new work for flute.
And we should give a shout out to your collaborating artist, Dmitry Kogan.
Yes, thank you. Dmitry Kogan is my a pianist of choice out here, and he's just incredible. I mean, you give him a score, he reads it like that, and then you rehearse it, and he finds things. In fact, he not only finds musical ideas that are wonderful, but he finds typos and mistakes. So often I'll tell the publisher, no, don't publish this yet. I've got to have a run-through with my pianist out here, because he will find whatever little mistakes there are. Anyway, he's a very, very versatile and gifted musician, and we have a great collaboration. We've been playing that for, I don't know how many years, 5 or 6 or 7 years out here.
Well,
by the way, it's just great to be out here because, you know, it's, for me, it's springtime.
I was going to say, you lucked out on getting out of town in time prior to those two blizzards.
I know, my wife's stuck there in the snow. I'm sorry.
Next time, bring her out.
I'll go back, and there'll be more snow end of March, and I'll be back. It goes on for a long time in Boston.
Well, since it is CPE Bach's birthday, we're going to go out with your recording of the Flute Concerto in G Major from the 1986 Marblehead Summer Music Festival.
Oh, my God.
We got a little bit of that for you
here. Oh, that's a live performance. Okay. Yeah.
And we'll encourage people to catch the concert tomorrow night. Thanks for talking with me, Bob. I'm looking forward.
Great. Thank you, David, so much.
Cheers.
Bye.
Robert Stallman performing C.P.E. Bach, whose birthday it is today, born on this date in 1714. Bob calls him the first romantic. The concert of Romantic Impulses at Old First Church tomorrow evening at 8, oldfirstconcerts.org for more information. Wonderful playing of Robert Stallman, music of C.P.E. Bach on his birthday today. Music of C.P.E. Bach, Jean-Jean, Takachvili, as well as premieres by Dvorak, Ravel, and Poulenc, as arranged by Bob Stallman, is at tomorrow's concert. It's a flute recital by Bob Stallman with Dmitry Kogan, pianist, at Old First Concerts. The concert's at 8 o'clock. Other wonderful things to catch here in the Bay Area this weekend are concerts at the San Francisco Symphony, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances, as well as Tippett's Ritual Dances from the Midsummer Marriage with guest conductor Edward Gardner. Information at sfsymphony.org. And just a couple more chances to catch the incredible production of Frankenstein at SF Ballet, an amazing score virtuosically performed by the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra under the direction of Martin West. Just running through the 11th, if you haven't caught it, do so. Go to sfballet.org. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. If you've got a show suggestion for me, by all means, send me an email. David@kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for maintaining the calendar, herding cats in preparation, as well as to Temu Atom for helping us out here. More information, again, is at our website, kalw.org. Thanks for listening.